Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. Well, I have a treat for you today. Her name is Sherry Snively, and I met her in the second week of December on Oahu, Hawaii, where I was attending a Reiki gathering for the weekend. And Sherry really intrigued me for a number of reasons, and the first was that she had this book with her that she had compiled and written, and I was really attracted to it. And part of the attraction for me was that, you know, I've always had this big question about when we get into these situations that are kind of have a lot of moral questions. What is the place of Reiki, and what is the place that I hold in this environment for myself? And I think that there's a lot of places that we can extrapolate from, but mostly it's my own discomfort with war, and how I hope that there is in our lifetime another way to resolve disagreements. In my last 63 years, I've come to decide that maybe there's not, and maybe actually this is nature's way of relieving tension and pressure and awakening us to some other way, and as a motivation to do something different. Somebody once asked me, what does world peace really look like? And I have to say that I didn't have an image of that. So I'm kind of working on that question still. Sherry's book really brought home to me that there is a spark of life, a spark of spirit, and a spark of tenderness in wartime, and that we can find that, and that's why I really love her book. I've read a little quote from her book in the New Year's program that I did in January, and I hope that you can go back there and revisit this program. So, Sherry, thank you very much for making this time to be with us.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, you know, Sherry's, there's a lot of places to start with you, but I think we'll start with Reiki. Like, how did you meet Reiki? Or if you need to go even back further about how your life was right up to that point, that's also okay.
Okay.
Just start wherever you want.
All right. Well, I'm a chaplain, and I'm a Navy chaplain. And as I was in the process early on, in about 1996, as a reservist, I was also working at a civilian hospital. And it was when I was working at the civilian hospital that the daughter of one of my patients came to me with a flyer about some alternative healing techniques and a class that she was going to, and she was hoping that it would help her mother. And she was going to attend the class, and I decided that I would too. Now, interestingly enough, it was a flyer about healing touch. And so I went and I attended the class, but it was through that class that I saw a flyer about Reiki.
Oh.
And so that was 1996. Again, I was working at a hospital. And I think that for me, the journey really towards Reiki began probably 3 years prior to that, as I was also working at another hospital, a Navy hospital at the time. And I was new in the ministry. I was had no experience in hospitals, didn't know really what I was doing or what I was supposed to be doing there as a chaplain. And so as I struggled with that, I would spend every morning in the small side chapel just sort of meditating on what it was that I was there for and how to really connect with people. And I came to discover, I guess with a new understanding, some of the gospel stories where Jesus was walking and wandering, talking with people and reaching out and touching them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really struck me that maybe that was my job too, to walk and wander, to talk, and to reach out and touch. So then about 3 years later, when I was introduced to Reiki, it was the natural progression of maybe a more systematic approach to bringing that kind of hands-on healing mm-hmm. and that divine universal energy to people that are hurting.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah. So that was the beginning. And I had Reiki 1 in 1996, and then about a year later I took Reiki 2.
Uh-huh.
Used it fairly extensively in hospital ministry and hospice. I worked at San Diego Hospice for about 6 years and used it a lot in hospice ministry. And then...
Excuse me.
Sure.
What does that mean, used it in hospice ministry? Like, does that mean that you treated people that you were talking to, or how did that look? I'm just wondering.
Well, in hospice, typically people have 6 months or less to live, uh-huh. so they're terminally ill.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, families and friends and loved ones always hope for the ultimate miracle of complete physical healing, but as we know, that often doesn't happen. And so in hospice, part of it is helping the person not only come to terms with the reality of the fact that they're facing death, but then to help them transition into a much more peaceful death.
Mm-hmm.
And so Reiki would do all of those things. I mean, I was using Reiki on a patient at one point who the nurses and people said that he only had about 3 weeks left to live. Well, through, I think, a chain of events and probably through Reiki energy and some other things, he ended up living an extra year. He got to see a grandchild born. He got to do some more work with his family in terms of making peace with some mm-hmm. difficult relationships. And he and I, as chaplain and patient, had a very intriguing spiritual companionship at that point. So it was a real win-win, I think, for everyone. So each individual story is as individual as the person,
uh-huh.
and
uh-huh.
so Reiki will be individual in each case.
Uh-huh. So you treated the people who were in the hospice,
yes.
And then did you treat the families also?
Not usually. Usually
uh-huh.
it was patient-centered,
uh-huh.
Patient-focused.
Okay, just checking. Thanks.
Yeah.
Please.
And I used that fairly extensively for about 3 years. And then for, I don't know exactly what reason, sometimes life is like a wave and you fade,
right.
you fade in and out of it. And even though you've seen some pretty powerful things happen with Reiki energy, for whatever reason, you sort of move away from it for
mm-hmm.
a while.
Right.
And I found myself moving away from it. And really didn't reconnect back with it until 2005, when I came to Hawaii to work with the Marines who were coming back from the Battle of Fallujah. I was over here. I was sent over here by the Navy for about 4 months to work with small group trauma processing for the guys that were coming home. And it was reconnecting then with Reiki here in Hawaii that really kind of set me in motion, and I didn't know it at the time, but I think really setting the stage for me to be able to go to Iraq and do what I did over there. Because eventually, several years later, in Iraq, I would be called to work the trauma hospital in the morgue. And so I think reconnecting with that Reiki energy, as well as doing some other spiritual practices, including journaling, getting back into some creative spirituality, taking photographs as part of my spiritual journey,
uh-huh.
and doing a lot of kind of creative things, I think all set the foundation for me to be able then to go and do what I was able to do in a combat zone and be there for people and try to help them have some hope and some healing in the midst of one of the most devastating kinds of things anybody can ever
mm-hmm.
live through or witness or be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's It would be good just to connect all the pieces, well, not all, but some of the pieces together, to find out, so how did you become a Navy chaplain? I guess that's an interesting story, too. Before we go any further?
Yes. I started out as an engineer. I was working as an engineer at General Dynamics. The story behind that, I guess the kind of the short version, is my father was a Navy pilot for 30 years. World War II era, he started out as an enlisted pilot in World War II. And he spent 30 years in the Navy. And my mother, her whole family was Quaker all the way back to the beginning of the movement in the mid-1600s in England.
Wow.
And so in a sense, I find myself at the crossroads between between the two of them because I'm a Quaker minister. And so I'm a Quaker minister in the military, which is an interesting twist because of the Quakers' historical pacifist understanding and outlook on life. And for me, I don't see that as being a conflict because I'm there. I'm a non-combatant by law. I do not carry a weapon, cannot carry a weapon. And so I am there for people. I am there for the human side of it. For a lot of our people in the military, not only are we there as chaplains to help facilitate and provide religious services for when they're deployed so that they have the free exercise of religion. I mean, that's that's the first and foremost reason we're there. The other aspect is to just care for all, and we are that one human contact point that's outside of, like, the chain of command where people can come and just pour their hearts out or just they need somebody to listen. They just need a hug. They just need somebody to say, hey, how's it going? That chaplain can be that link. And so I don't see that as being a conflict because I'm there for the people, and I'm also there for friend and foe. I mean, when we were working in the trauma hospital, we treated everybody in the hospital. We treated alleged insurgents, and we gave them the same level of care and the same compassion. And so for me, what an amazing opportunity to be able to do that.
Beautiful. So I was talking to somebody maybe yesterday about you and how excited I was to be able to have this time with you. And I said, and she's, you know, a Quaker chaplain. And they go, so? And I said, yes, but they're pacifists. And then they looked at me like, so? And then I thought, well, you know, it's so interesting that I don't think of Christians as being pacifists. And I realized that that was some kind of an interesting, I can't say it's a belief system, but it is some kind of interesting connection that I have made and kept it that way. So I don't know whether it's because I've read a lot about the Crusades or what, but I always thought that this was kind of taking it up to the next level. But this person I was speaking to, unfortunately, I don't even remember who this was just talking to me and saying, but surely all chaplains are pacifists. And I went, interesting. So I just wonder how that is for you, carrying the legacy.
It's interesting. I mean, I feel a certain responsibility, you know, to that understanding. And in answer, you know, I can't speak for every chaplain, but certainly, again, all of us are non-combatants, but each chaplain has their own understanding of how they've come to peace with, how they make peace with war, or how they how they interact in that kind of environment and their own personal beliefs. And it's very different. I mean, so it's all across the board. I know for me, and one of the stories in my book, I was doing the Marine Corps martial arts training while I was over there in Iraq, which is a hand-to-hand martial arts kind of training. And I got about halfway through, maybe two-thirds of the way through the training, and I remember distinctly one day, and it was actually after a Reiki experience, the night before I had initiated somebody in Reiki 1, because before I left for Iraq in 2005, there was a woman, I was working in Memphis, Tennessee with Katrina refugees, and we were doing small group trauma processing for the people that had experienced the trauma of Hurricane Katrina. And there was a woman who knew me, and this was before I ever knew that I was going to Iraq, but she felt led to offer to initiate me as a master. And I said, well, let me think about that. So I thought about that for a week or so. And I went ahead and said yes. And I think one of the reasons, obviously, that I said yes, I didn't know it at the time, was that somehow it was going to be helpful to me over in Iraq. And indeed it was. So this one particular evening in Iraq, I had been asked by somebody who had been on a journey, a spiritual journey, had been interested in learning about Reiki, had not known how to do it. She was from Texas. She hadn't made any connections or anything. She was a reservist. She was over there working for me. Lo and behold, we land together at the same place, serving at the same time. She finds out that I'm a Reiki master, and she was kind of blown away by that. And I was kind of intrigued by the fact that she had been wanting to know more about Reiki, and here we are, landed smack dab together, so that was no accident. So I had taught her, and I had initiated her that previous night. Well, the very next morning at 07, I was in the tent doing martial arts training, got about a third of the way through the training that morning, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I sat down on the mat, and one of the Marines that was doing the training said, are you okay, ma'am? Are you going to keep on training? And I said, no. And he says, what's the matter? Are you injured? I said, no, I just can't do this. The energy is just 180 degrees opposite. And the way I describe it is about making connection, but one was in that energy of complete universal love, and the other is about just being able to manage a violent situation, but with a very different kind of physical connection. Right. Nobody that goes into that training wants to do people harm, but there are times when you do have to take control in physical ways that, at least at that point, was very uncomfortable for me. So I just sat on the mat and said, I can't continue doing this training right now because the energy was just so discordant for me. So it gave it a very interesting opportunity to have a conversation with the Marines. I mean, I wasn't trying to convert him, but it was just he was intrigued by that.
Yeah.
About, okay, you mean like you don't even want to defend yourself? And I said, no, not necessarily. I mean, if for me at that point, I was so open and my heart was so open and had been so open by Reiki energy and that I couldn't even imagine striking somebody back, even if they were trying to attack me. And so it was very intriguing. The Marine was puzzled. And so I had a lot of opportunities to have conversations like that. Not trying to convert them, but just talk about my own journey, my own spiritual journey, and trying to live that, kind of walking that fine line of trying to be the peacemaker and be the one that maybe lives a little bit differently or maybe more in touch with the spirit or maybe more in touch with that love energy than some people, and especially in a difficult environment.
Well, there's a martial art that I've experienced just very briefly and to the side, but it's called Aikido, and it was developed in Japan about the same time as Reiki. And it is a self-defense art. And basically, the philosophy is that everything is energy, and you just embrace the energy that comes towards you, whether it's a hug or a stab, and you use that energy to allow it to flow past you or to flow over you, as in the person goes over your head or whatever. It's really interesting to play around with that. But when you're in Iraq, you're not playing.
Right.
And earlier today, we were talking about this human way that we have, obviously, like our defense mechanisms, you know, that there is a lot of talk about, well, in my circles, because I'm not in the military, and, you know, we're always trying to figure out how people get to the point of killing somebody else. So, you know, I wonder about all the separation that happens within the training to be a soldier, and then the separation, and then, you know, your ability to be able to go in and actually not be separated. So can you talk a little bit about that? Do you get where I'm going? Or kind of, I'm hoping to give you a topic sentence that you can talk
to. Sort of. I think I kind of get what you're...
Well, it's my theory. Let me put it this way. It's my theory that for soldiers to go and actually be trained, you know, as a reflex to shoot at somebody, to kill them, that they have to, number one, this is my sense, they have to, number one, be in fear, and they have to be sensitive to those forces that are, the force, the energy that's coming to them, that wants to kill them, and so they respond in like. Mm. And I'm just wondering, these people maybe have all these defense mechanisms that are in place, and as a another side of the coin, perhaps, you went there with yourself wide open, with as little defense mechanism as possible.
Right.
So I'm just wondering how that was for you, and this story about the martial arts seems to...
Well, I think...
kind of go in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I think that, again, in one of the stories I talk about kind of that people, once you're over there, you're there for the people that you're with.
Right.
I mean, you kind of bond together, and, you know, you're there for your buddy on your right and your buddy on the left, and you'd put your life on the line
for them.
And that's really not the time to have the philosophical conversation about why we're in the middle of the war.
Right.
You know, that's for the coffee house when you get back stateside before the next election. You know, you can then have the conversation with each other and your friends about what are we doing and why. And that's an important conversation to have. I think that especially people that have been there have some important things to add to the conversation about how do we do this differently. So there were those of us, especially the ones that were working in the hospital and the morgue, seeing what we were seeing every day, you know, we would ask those questions of what in the heck is going on here, and is this worth it, and can't there be a different way? But day after day, we had to keep on, so there was no answer to that question, and so we kind of pushed that aside and kept working. From the other perspective of how I got to that point, I mean, not only, I guess, because of what I do as a chaplain, I come at it from I see my role very differently, because I see my role as helping people maintain their connection with spirit, their own spirit of God, whatever you want to term it. And again, I think it's something that I learned here in Hawaii, actually in 2005. And it's what I term aloha. And for me, it boils down to connection. And what I mean by connection is connection within yourself to your own spirit, connection to a bigger spirit, divine, universal energy, whatever you want to call it. So, and then ultimately connection with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're connected within yourself with the divine, then you're able to connect with that same energy, oneness, to everybody. And that in itself is transformative. But then when you take the connection, put it with compassion,
mm-hmm,
and gratitude and flow, it becomes this magic mix that I call aloha. So connection, compassion, gratitude, and flow. And that's how I went over to Iraq,
uh-huh,
was with that understanding and taking the kind of energy that Reiki is to go over with the intention to live that way.
Uh-huh.
So wherever I was, that was how I was trying to be.
Uh-huh.
And for me, it made a huge difference in not only what I was able to do, but the way people interacted. It shifted the balance. I mean, it did shift things energetically at times.
Huh. Do you have a story about that comes to mind?
Well, I remember one young man who had come in to the hospital, and it looked like he needed some surgery. And of course, surgery in a combat zone is not something that you want to have happen unless it's an emergency. And he was needing some care. And after he got recovered at least a day or two, come out of the surgery, he started talking to me one day, and he said, "You know, there's something about you that's different." He says, "I've been watching you, and I don't get it. I don't understand it. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is?" And so I basically shared with him what I just shared, and then I started talking about Reiki. And this was a young man who was having some problems with PTSD as well as his injury, or his surgery, what had caused the need for surgery. And I began doing Reiki on him with his permission every evening. He was there for a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks total. And it really began to shift his mindset. He had come in very angry, very uptight. He had been through a lot. This was his second or third deployment. He had seen buddies die. He had actually had a buddy die in his arms. He had actually accidentally killed a child, an Iraqi child. He'd come back home after that deployment and not found any relief in his traditional church, or he was just not finding any kind of connection or relief for his pain. So as we began to talk, and along with the compassionate care from the doctors and the nurses that we had there, he found a place to rest.
Wow.
And so Reiki for him became a moment of time where he was able to rest.
Uh-huh.
So it was just that, it was almost like a little oasis. And I'll never know what happened to him. I've tried to maintain connections with him because he was also one that I initiated in Reiki. He ended up asking me to initiate him. So this was a young man who was in the infantry, in the army. He was really struggling with a lot of things, but yet he had seen something, I guess, in me that intrigued him and said, "Hey, I want to know what that is, and can you help me?
Uh-huh.
Can you help me find some of that?" And so I did. And it was really a beautiful story, and I often think about him, and there's no way for me to contact him, but I trust that, you know, that part, our paths crossed, the journey, you know, there was no accident there, and that somehow that seed that was planted will somehow come to fruition in his life.
Uh-huh.
And that those moments, those memories, will be for him still, even as he faced some real hardship in the future, because he did have traumatic brain injury, he had terrible PTSD, he was being forced out of the Army. So he had a long road ahead of him that from the traditional standpoint would not look like an easy road or a happy life. But I hope that that moment, that those moments that we shared together, will be a place that he can return to as an oasis and say, okay, there's hope along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what it's going to look like.
Right.
Not sure when it's coming, but I got to keep looking because somewhere it's here. It's around the corner.
Uh-huh.
And it may not look like what he expected it to look like.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, just like that. I mean, we had a random sort of chance encounter, and certainly I'm sure he didn't expect to have anything like that happen with a chaplain because he wanted nothing to do with chaplains or religion. So, you know, isn't that an interesting twist?
Yeah, very.
So.
Very. I guess it's time to ask you about your book. Like, when did you have this idea that you were going to write this book? You mentioned that you were journaling, and so you did some of that. You did that when you were in Iraq. I guess it was a possibility of holding a place for yourself.
Exactly. I began journaling when I was here in Hawaii in 2005, working with the Marines. The Quakers have a long, long tradition of using journals mm-hmm. as a spiritual tool, actually.
Right.
And I had always felt somewhat guilty about not journaling. I'd always thought, you know, you should journal, you should do this. Well, and I never did. And then all of a sudden, somehow, spontaneously, when I was here in 2005, I just began journaling. And I think it was because there were so many profound experiences happening with me that I wanted to remember
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like a whole new world opened up for me, and I wanted to record that. So I did. So I think that I was in that mode. And then put together, I continued journaling when I went to Memphis. And the other thing that got added in Memphis for me was I was reconnected with photography. I'd always done photography sort of as a hobby as a child. I'd been in 4-H, a youth organization, and that was one of my projects in 4-H. But I hadn't done any photography for a long time, and a friend of mine who I had met through some interesting circuitous routes, actually through a drum circle, he was a photographer. He saw a few of my snapshots, and he was really encouraging and said, hey, you've got a real eye for this. You need to do this. So before I left Memphis, he and I had a small show together at a little venue in Memphis. And so those two things came together for me, sort of the journaling in writing and the journaling, the photographic journal.
Uh-huh.
And so what had happened there was really it set the foundation for me to not only record my Iraq experiences, but I think as a method to cope.
Uh-huh.
Because I went to Iraq working, I had four units basically under my care. I was there for the trauma hospital, the morgue, for the EOD guys, which are the bomb guys that were out on the roads hunting the IEDs and trying to keep the roads clear and safe, and then comm company, the communications company. So I was busy all the time, and obviously with the trauma hospital and the morgue, those were really difficult places to be. And then who does the chaplain talk to?
Right.
So
exactly.
I think there, you know, I talked to my journal
mm-hmm.
and my camera spoke. And so I think that for me it was a way to not only record what was going on, but to get it out. I would call it, there were several of the moments and evenings when I would go back and I would do what I called puking it up onto the page.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we'd seen was so horrible that where else was I going to go with that?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me it was a way to get it out, but also a way to put it somewhere where it was safe, because these are sacred stories. And I've come up with a saying that you don't want to remember because they're so horrible. But on the other hand, because they are so sacred, you don't want to forget.
Mm.
And so for me, the journal, and now the book, ultimately, has become a safe place, a sacred space, to put those stories, but to put them in a place that's outside of me, so I'm not necessarily having to carry all of the details. Mm-hmm. But yet I know they're in a place where they're safe. I can revisit them. Sometimes I do revisit them like old friends. Sometimes they come back at me and revisit me like old friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the triggers on something like this can be kind of interesting and can catch you off guard and unaware and at the most interesting times. But I don't fear that anymore.
That's great.
Because I'm not, you know, again, it's energy.
Mm-hmm.
So when that energy comes at you, you recognize it. You go, oh, okay. And you kind of, you ride the wave. It's almost like surfing. I don't surf. I mean, I can watch these surfers in Hawaii and stand in amazement. But really, in some ways, riding that kind of heavy energy, and especially when you're in the moment of the energy of a combat trauma hospital or a combat morgue, it really is like riding one of these big waves, I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know from personal experience, but it's to try to catch that wave and hang on and just ride it
mm-hmm.
with all of its ups and downs and go with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And not get consumed by it.
Right.
And not get totally wiped out by it.
Right.
Either in the moment as it's happening, like over in Iraq, or in the moment as it's happening if mm-hmm. you're having a flashback.
Right.
Or if you're having a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of like riding a knife edge.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta be right in that zone and try to not let it wipe you out.
So tell me about the process of your book. So you came back from Iraq, and then did you have the idea while you were in Iraq that you were going to put it together?
I suppose I had some idea. I mean, I think I went over there initially thinking about my photography and thinking about capturing the extraordinary moments in the ordinary
right.
photos.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over there looking. Actually, I knew that one of the ways I was going to keep my sanity was to look for those little places of beauty, to look for, like in one of the stories I talk about, looking even for a small blade of grass or looking for a small flower
mm-hmm.
in this vast expanse of nothing but sand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I went over there thinking as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had just had a show, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I'll put together a photographic show at some point. And then as I journaled and as I began to take photographs, I began to wonder. I thought, well, okay, that's interesting. Maybe I could put the two together, because there were times when I could take photographs. There were other times when I couldn't take photographs. Obviously, most of the time in a hospital and a morgue,
right.
you're not allowed to take right. photographs. And you wouldn't want to. So there were moments when I had my camera and I would be able to take photographs at different places and different interactions around the base. And there were times when all I could do was create a word picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to see that maybe those two would come together. And I wasn't actively thinking about it, but I think it was there in the back of my mind. And so as I would journal to remember these experiences, as I would write emails to people, I guess I was developing a body of work from mm-hmm. which to draw. So then when I got home, I probably had about a third of the material, and then I began working on stories. Some of these stories just sort of demanded to be written. There's a story in here that I entitled The Cops, the Teacher, and the Beanie Babies. And it was after a night where we'd had a busload of Iraqi cops blown up. There were about 14 of them killed and about 11 injured. And it was just about that interaction with them and that week afterwards as they were in the hospital healing, and about the interaction with them with another Iraqi, a young man who was a teacher, and about the Beanie Babies that Americans were sending over for us to give to the Iraqi children, to try to keep our spirits up. And so it was a story about them and about those Beanie Babies. And it sounds kind of silly, but it was one of those stories that really just demanded to be written. And so I remember one day I was sitting at a Starbucks, and that story began to flow.
The Starbucks was not in Iraq.
No, the Starbucks was not in Iraq. It was when I was home. I was home. And although we did have a coffee house over there, it was not a Starbucks, but it was some commercial coffee house.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like the Coffee Bean Coffee House or something. I don't know what it, It was some chain. But when I was back here at home, as I was sitting in a Starbucks one day, this story just started to flow. And as the story began to flow, I was right back there in Iraq reliving it, and the tears began to flow. And I was thankful that I was sort of in the corner of this coffee house, because I'm sitting there at my computer writing and crying, but yet in some ways very happy that the story was coming out. Because it really is a lovely story. I mean, it's kind of sad because things were going on that were sad. People were dying, and, you know, we don't know what the situation will ultimately be in Iraq for the Iraqi people, and we hope the best, but yet it was a hopeful story. It was a story full of hope for the people that had survived the attack, and the fact that we were able to help them and hopefully give them some strength for their future. And strangely enough, interwoven through it was these Beanie Babies that were sent by caring Americans from all over America. We had boxes and boxes of Beanie Babies that were sent. And so in my book, there's a picture of these Iraqi guys in their hospital bed with the gray blanket being covered with all these colorful, colorful Beanie Babies. So
beautiful. So what do you hope for your book? What is your kind of, I don't know, you've produced the book, it's flowed out of you, and obviously it has been a part of your healing process, your wholeness process, I might say, and it's really wonderful. I mean, it's an odd thing to say about the book, because some people might think that it's a bit too confrontive, you know, about war and about unpeace. But for me, it's really about sort of the traditional thought about spiritual test. So, again, I have to refer back to my experience of Aikido and the way that I was introduced to it. And that is that in this martial art, there are several different levels of tests, which there are in every martial art, I would imagine. So you start out as a beginner, and you get kind of a beginner test. And then as you work your way up, and you learn the technique, and then you put your energy behind the technique, and so on, the tests become more and more intense, because it's important that in that moment where the test is your life, you want to be able to do it without thinking about it, going, oh, whoops, oh, that, gosh, I should have put my finger in this way, right? So, you know, it just feels like your experience, and the book gives us the possibility to share that experience of yours where you had in some way an ultimate test of your way of life, of your way of living, mm-hmm. and the energy that you went into the war with. Mm. And we might say, you know, in accompaniment with Reiki. And how you came out feels like one of those Reiki stories where there's a miracle, but it's not an obvious one. That's how I feel about it. And I feel like that's expressed in the book. So I'm just wondering, when you put the book out, did you have a wish about where this would go?
Interesting. And there are a couple of different ways to answer that.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah. You know, I think obviously anybody who's ever dreamed of writing a book has those moments where they think, oh, this will be so cool, and maybe I'll be rich and famous, and, you know,
uh-huh.
of course, that's a fleeting thought, and you soon get over that when you get into the nuts and bolts of everything.
Right.
I think for me, I describe it as being in concentric circles. For me, first of all, I wrote the book for my own mm-hmm. process.
Right.
Then I wrote it for my two little boys. My boys were 4 and 6 when I deployed. And I wanted them to understand what I did, where I went, and what I was doing, and why. Because, you know, my father spent 30 years in the Navy, and I know a few of his stories, but I really don't know the details.
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, one of the things that I would love to know more about was he went to flight school. He was in flight school when Pearl Harbor happened. They accelerated his class. He got out just in time for the Battle of Midway. It was his first assignment.
Wow.
First assignment.
Oh, it gives me goosebumps.
First assignment out of flight school.
Wow.
Sent to the Battle of Midway flying PBYs. Well, that's all I know. I don't know any of the details.
Or how he felt, or...
Exactly.
What he saw, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, to me, that's really incredibly sad. And now, I so often wish he were here so that we could talk about that. And we certainly could talk about it now in a way that was very different,
mm-hmm.
not just father and daughter, but basically warrior to chaplain or warrior to somebody that got it. Because those are not the kinds of conversations that you typically have with family,
right,
or with friends, or right. neighbors, or people that haven't been there.
Right.
But since I've now been initiated, so to speak, we could have a very different conversation.
Right.
Well, I didn't want my kids in that situation. I wanted them to understand. The other thing is, and it sounds kind of cliche, but it is stories... I mean, it tells the story of what a chaplain is and does, mm-hmm. at least from my perspective. It tells some incredible stories of our average, everyday, wonderful sailors, Marines, airmen, soldiers. It tells their story. And then beyond that, I think for me, it really is a spiritual story. It is it's a way of being. It's, and I remember as I got the book, or I knew the book was on its way, and I held the book in my hands for the first time, I remember saying this prayer, and it was, may everyone who touches this book be touched. Mm. Now, what that means and what that looks like, I don't know, because for me, there's a power and an energy to these stories that is really quite beyond me. I mean, these stories in some ways did come through me.
Right.
I think there's an energy that comes through this that really is not my own. And I think some people understand that, some people mm-hmm. get that. And that's what I wanted to share. Now, where it goes from here, I have no idea. I mean, from a logical standpoint or a practical standpoint, sure, I'd love to have the book picked up by a publisher, or I'd love to have it be a springboard for something,
right?
You know, for me to maybe write some other books, or to maybe go on a speaking circuit, or I don't know. I don't know what that looks like and what that means, but I have always thought about this book that there's something here that needs to go beyond beyond just sort of the local level. Some of this does need to get out there,
right?
In a broader sense,
right?
Just because these are the kinds of stories, these are the kinds of spiritual stories that people need to know. This is what's possible. If you open yourself up. Now, and I thank you for, you know, making the comment that, yes, it was a test. It was one of those miracle kinds of places. And, yes, I think that perhaps I passed that test.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the more interesting things, and it could be a, you know, topic for another conversation, is the next level test.
Right, because there's always the next level.
There's always the next level.
Yes.
And in some ways, I'm struggling with that next level a lot more. And it's the level of how to come home,
uh-huh.
and how to reintegrate, and the what now, and mm-hmm. the what next. And after you've had this kind of experience, what do you do with that? And how do you bring it back into sort of the quote, real world? I think sometimes it's easy in a... in a very severe environment like a combat zone, to live differently. Because it is life or death. You're living on the edge every day.
Right.
And so you have nothing to lose, so to speak, by going out there and just living on the edge. I mean, it's
right.
like, okay, I'm going to be completely wide open here
mm-hmm.
and see where it takes me. And then when we get home, things change.
Right.
And defense mechanisms and other things come kicking back in because it's not quite so hard at home.
Mm-hmm.
But in other ways, it's much harder.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Totally. I mean, you know, it's kind of no surprise. Well, that's kind of a weird way to put it. When I was a child, I would read about, like, Tibetan monks or the Catholic monks who went in these little caves, you know, and kind of didn't eat and didn't do anything, and they kind of barely existed, right? Because they put all their energy, this is my thing, put all their energy into being spiritual or being connected with God and so on. And I thought, well, like, why does that have to happen? Like, why can't you just live in a regular house and do the same thing? Well, it's kind of the same question. It's like when you're really out there and you're stripped of all your social norms, like there are no norms, and, you know, you've left one world behind,
right.
then, you know, you're out there and you're either connected, as you said, or you're not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you come back, then luxury can be something that is cushioning in some way on an emotional and psychological level, but it could also be debilitating.
Right.
Because it's so much. And I think that one of the things that I got in your book, and I don't know how I got this, is that I always, when I'm talking to a group of Reiki students, I always say, you know, we live in luxury. You may not know that this is luxury, but only 100 years ago, and in most of the planet, they are still doing this. They are spending 18 hours a day trying to feed their families, however that is, whether it's farming or fishing or, you know, doing bead work to trade for food or whatever it is, that's the level of their existence. And we call it third world, but actually it's just being human.
Right.
And what we've layered on that has been this luxury And I feel that it's been my, it's my responsibility to use that luxury wisely. And time is a luxury. So, you know, I don't have to spend 18 hours a day farming. In order to grow my own vegetables, I go down and buy them off an organic, hopefully, farmer, and they do that, but they do it because they, in turn, get money and so on, and the wheel goes around and around. So when I think about, and I can only surmise because obviously I haven't had experience, but when I think about that, it, like, I can't imagine what it must be like to come back into whatever normal means, normal life, have this cushioning and this kind of complacency in some way that is really spiritually, and I feel like, which is really spiritual debilitating, right, on some level. Do you think that's true?
I think so, and I think that that explains why so many people that have deployed to combat zones do struggle when they come back. There are many ways that they describe it, but one of the ways they describe it is everything's just so slow, or everything,
right,
it's so kind of, in some ways, meaningless, or they're looking for, I think from probably a physiological or biological standpoint, they're looking for the adrenaline rush.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're out there and you don't know literally whether you're going to live or die, and every time you go out on the road on the mission, you know, you could be blown up by an IED, and it happens periodically, and you know, that does something not only to your psyche, but I think it obviously revs you up and pumps you up with the adrenaline. And so when people come home, how do you fill that,
right,
that void? And everything just kind of feels dull by comparison, and in some ways nothing, or a lot of the stuff that goes on in kind of normal life just seems so blasé. It's like it just, almost meaningless. I don't want to say meaningless, because that's not exactly the right term, because there's a lot of meaningful things in our lives, or there should be, or there really is if we look around,
right,
and open our eyes to it.
Right, right.
But it doesn't seem that way.
Right, right. So, do you have any kind of strategy?
Well, you know, where I am kind of circling back around to, with, I guess, renewed understanding or perhaps renewed commitment to trying to do it, is to go right back to where kind of I started. I mean, it is an energy situation. It is an energy thing. To reconnect with Reiki,
mm-hmm,
to reconnect our connection, compassion, gratitude, and flow, and to try to keep staying in that place, and to nurture that energy in the midst of wherever you find yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have I been successful with that? Sometimes.
Mm. Well, for some people, that's a lot sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, too, that's one of the things that I've realized, is that a lot of people just don't spend much time or thought at all to these bigger questions.
Yes.
Or to spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
They get caught in the day-to-day stuff, and some of that's necessary, of course. But I think that, in general, we don't look at these harder issues or harder questions. And we spend our time doing, I don't know, frivolous-like things. And
mm-hmm,
we all fall into that.
Yes.
And it is a way of distracting ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of numbing ourselves.
Right.
And so I think, for me, one of my continuing lessons is not to do that, to find a way to still stay open, and to try to work with that energy and try to transmute it.
Great. Thanks, Sherry.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.